Hello, and I'm Jennifer Udden of the Donald Moss Literary Agency.
And I'm Bridget Smith of Dunham Literary.
And this is Shipping and Handling, and today we have a very special guest.
Today we have Ryan Britt, who is the former staff writer for Tor.com. So if you read Tor.com at all, you have probably read at least a couple of his articles and probably completely agreed with one and wanted to light him on fire for the other. That's generally how responses go. Ryan is also a general writer person with a couple of stories and essays published recently, and one coming up next week.
A story in Cross Genres, which is released on Friday. His writing also appears in the New York Times and in Nerve. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. This is lovely. And this, can I talk about the wine?
You can. Yeah. You can.
The wine is good.
It's an open secret.
We usually have to cut out the refill noises, but you're good.
It's okay. I know how to pour wine silently, so it's like they teach you that in spy school.
first he brought us cookies, and now he's going to be able to silently refill wine.
We're going to have it back again.
Yay.
So... You want
to? Okay. You go. Well, today we wanted to talk about adaptations, which is something that you have often had to write about in the course of your reviewing history. So we were thinking, to start the discussion, what do you think makes a good adaptation? What are you looking for in an adaptation?
What you can't see is that I was giving Bridget a knowing nod. Yes, I've had to review many adaptations. I think that the topic is super fun because, you know, most of what we see that are big blockbusters are some kind of adaptation or another, whether it's in a comic book movie or a novel or a short story. You know, I'll think of something that's based on a short story momentarily. There's got to be something. Benjamin Button, right? Button's a novella. I think that what I look for is different than I think what a lot of people look for. I think for me, I look for sort of like the essence of whatever the point of the original source material was, rather than, you know, necessarily the plot. You know,
the faithfulness.
I think that faithfulness is super dangerous. You know what I mean?
Which was actually the problem with Watchmen, is that they were so careful and they got certain, like, the shots that everyone makes fun of are directly lifted from the graphic novel, but they sort of missed the point a little bit, and that's what everyone got so upset about.
Yeah, I think that there was also some strange musical cues in Watchmen that were a little on the nose.
True.
You know, using All Along the Watchtower in Battlestar Galactica is one thing. Using it in Watchmen is another thing. Like, I think that that's like...
Yeah.
I always kind of made the joke that the Hunger Games should have used that that song from Dirty Dancing, Hungry Eyes, you know, or like Hungry Like the Wolf, you know, just like really just like
somewhere
on the nose.
Somewhere out there, there is,
you know,
a fan, like, video of Gale, oh, Katniss, absolutely, and Peeta set to Hungry
Eyes. You know, like, I just feel like that would be... That's the ideal, right? You know? But yeah, I think the Hunger Games is actually a great example also of something that's a little too faithful in terms of the events, for the most part, that happen. Just with Catching Fire coming out, like, and I think that no one who is a Hunger Games fan would be like, the Hunger Games movie was terrible. But I think that most fans of the books are like, it wasn't quite what we wanted, you know? And I think that part of it is because, and I think that people maybe don't really think about this, but like, it didn't utilize the medium of a film at all, you know?
Yeah.
The people in The Hunger Games are watching a television program.
Yeah.
They're watching a film. And so wouldn't it be interesting to use that in a film? But then of course you'd have to restructure the entire plot.
Yeah.
And then and then your hardcore fans, your fangirls and your fanboys would freak out.
And they're your bread and butter.
So. Exactly.
But at the same time, I think that the ones sort of are able to stand on their own and do really well are the ones that are more sort of, as you said, you know, faithful to the feeling and not necessarily to the plot. Like, I have gotten in so many awkward arguments with J.R.R. Tolkien fanboys who just hate the movies because they're not faithful to the original books, and they cut out, you know, fucking Tom Bombadil. Like, thank God they cut out Tom Bombadil. That would be an unwatchable movie.
Unless Bill Murray had played him, you know, and then it would have been fine.
Acceptable.
You know?
Okay. I concede that point. However, he didn't, and we're all better off for it.
I mean, Tolkien's a really good example of... And one of my favorite topics when you talk about adaptations are when the adaptations are actually better And not better in that they are more original, but just that they're more, they make the material more relevant. How do you make a mainstream film that has practically no women in it? You know what I mean? Like, I remember someone being very upset when the first one came out and, you know, Liv Tyler is given Gandalf's magical moment in the river.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, of course I would have made the same decision as the screenwriters, you know, to do that. To that point, as I remember when the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out, I was in college. That dates me. My friend and I had a Tolkien party, and her father was a big Lord of the Rings fan. Like, he dressed up as Gandalf and stuff like that. And she was like, let's do this thing where we only show the first movie was out and the second movie was coming out. So we had the DVD of Fellowship, mm-hmm. and she's like, but let's only show the animated ones and pretend like we don't know what anyone's talking about. If they bring up the Peter Jackson ones, like, what? No, it's all about the Orson Bean ones, right? Or there's that song, The Greatest Adventure, you know, like, and like, and in the Tolkien ones are really interesting. I don't know how much, you know, you guys know, but there's The Hobbit.
I think I've seen The Hobbit, animated Hobbit.
The animated Hobbit, and then there's different people, it's Rankin and Bass that do the Hobbit, and mm-hmm. then it's a different company, what is his name? He did Wizards, Bashki. Did this one that was called The Lord of the Rings, which is essentially just the Fellowship of the Rings and the Two Towers. And then Rankin and Bass had the rights to Return of the King. So then there's this like random cartoon called Return of the King, which is essentially a sequel to the cartoon Hobbit and also the story of Return of the King.
But it's made by different people.
It's made by different people that did the Lord of the Rings movie in between, a completely different animation style and completely inconsistent. And so the Return of the King cartoon opens with it opens with it's Bilbo's birthday again. And they're just like, I'm really old, Frodo, how did you lose that finger? And then this minstrel comes out and
Frodo,
is like,
how did you lose that finger?
And he's like, it's a crazy story, you know. And then this minstrel appears from nowhere and sings a song called Frodo of the Nine Fingers and the Ring of Doom, and there's this, it's like music, you know, and it's like John Huston plays Gandalf, and like,
of course he does.
There's a song that I used to drive crazy. The staff at tor.com used to hate it when I would queue up this YouTube video where the orcs sing a marching song called Where There's a Whip, There's a Way. And this is like the piece of Tolkien lore you don't understand, because like, they didn't want to fight, it turns out, in this song. They're just like, we don't want to go to war today. And it's like, the whole pathos of the orcs is totally...
Oh my god.
But yeah, these are, I mean, talk about confusing, you know, generations of people. If you just saw The Hobbit, the cartoons, you know, you'd be like, wow, this is really stupid.
Yeah.
You know?
But I think that, you know, any adaptation also has to stand on its own as a thing if you mm-hmm. have not read the books. So
yes.
in that vein, like, I'm not upset if they had chosen to make Hunger Games slightly better and maybe ignored some of the finer plot points and then maybe put a camera on, like, a steady cam and not shaking it about so much, but that's another thing. You know, then I think that it would have been a good movie in itself.
One of the things that I actually really liked about The Hunger Games was, well, one, Jennifer Lawrence was fantastic. But for another, I really liked how they actually sort of removed themselves from her perspective and showed us the games makers and how they were actually going about setting this into motion. I thought that made the both the story much more sort of comprehensible to a new
mm-hmm.
audience,
yeah.
but also added a different dimension to the story that I found very interesting.
Yeah,
you got to see what Woody Harrelson was up to, you know, like, you had, like, how those deals got made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that was one of my favorite parts of it too.
What's his face and his beard?
Oh, Wes Bentley.
Yeah,
and his amazing facial
Seneca
hair.
Crane. Yeah,
yeah, like Tony Stark on acid. That was his facial hair.
Yeah.
Too bad. I mean, it's such a great actor and such a great character. I wish that the story didn't require him to die.
I know.
Yeah, that would have been nice.
I'm just glad that he's making a comeback, Wes Bentley, because he was, I guess, lost to time and heroin there for a while, and now he's back.
Well, they've really changed the story for Catching Fire. He's a ghost in this one. I don't want to
remember Katniss. Remember who you are.
I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but the ghost of Seneca Crane, that deleted chapter. That Suzanne Collins.
He didn't eat the berries. He somehow got out of that room.
It's like a Sherlock Holmes thing. He faked his death. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of Sherlock, you know, right now we have two major television adaptations, and it has been so fascinating to watch the way that both of them have handled this mythos of this character that's so beloved and interested. Like,
I think he's the
most interpreted character in the English language.
I looked this up once, and I think that like it's only beat by like Scrooge. Like Scrooge is one of the other is like in terms of characters, and I think that like Jesus is like on that list if he's a character, you know. But
he's
yeah.
a real person.
The Sorry, funny thing about that. Sherlock Holmes might be Jesus. You can cut that too.
He probably thinks he's Jesus.
The funny thing about Sherlock and I've written a lot about Sherlock Holmes extensively for Tor.com, and you know I wrote an article for Clark's World about Sherlock Holmes where I got to interview a lot of Sherlock Holmes experts, like Nicholas Meyer, who wrote you know, The Wrath of Khan, but more importantly wrote all these Sherlock Holmes, all these Sherlock Holmes pastiches, you know, The 7% Solution. The thing that people forget about Sherlock Holmes adaptations with Basil Rathbone is that most of the Basil Rathbone adaptations are not in the correct time period. It's World War II. There's very few of the Basil Rathbones that are actually in the Victorian setting. Then you've got, you know, Peter Cushing, you know, Hound of the Baskervilles, which is a total, the story is like very, very different. It wasn't until the 80s with Jeremy Brett that there were straight adaptations. Mm. There were none prior to that. Even the Basil Rathbone ones changed things. And most of the sort of Sherlock Holmes adaptations came from the play that was written by William Giletti, who was the first actor to play Sherlock Holmes, which was a five-act play written by Conan Doyle, which was kind of a combination of The Final Problem and like Scandal in Bohemia and all these stories that then William Giletti, this American, an American was the first person to adapt and play Sherlock Holmes, changed.
Take that, people who horror. Take that, people who hate Elementary irrationally.
Well, Johnny Lee Miller is English.
Yeah, and he's playing and...
Well, no, but there, I remember when Elementary was a thing that was happening, and I was guilty.
It still
of this.
Is, yeah.
I mean, but before it was a thing. When it was just a thing that you know CBS is going to do it. CBS, the home of NCIS and CSI, it's going to be terrible. Americans ruining everything. Yeah. And then it was like, wait, we actually have a really good handle on this, because I think that you know, no matter who's doing it, you know, the two adaptations that are happening right now, you could argue that they're both extremely faithful to the original stories, just in their own, you know, sort of unique
ways. Yeah, not the plots, you know what I mean? And I think that what's interesting about Sherlock Holmes, where it stands apart, is that most people who know of Sherlock Holmes, which is almost everyone, are unfamiliar with the actual specific stories. Moriarty's only in two stories. They're
very minor character.
Almost half the stories don't involve murder. You know what I mean? And which is something that kind of bothers me about Elementary, you know, because it's kind of a it's like Sherlock Holmes was not necessarily whodunits. You know, they would sort of it was scandals, you know, and the blackmail and like, you know, missing people that are missing. But
and stolen items.
Yeah.
And people pretending to be richer than they are need to be put in their place.
So I think that with, you know, when Sherlock, the BBC show with Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman came out, like
10 points for saying his name correctly on the first go, because I've just taken to calling him Crumbly Buns because I can never get it out right.
Well, Cumberbatch is great just because, like, you know, obviously writing about that show for, I think I was the first person to write about it for Tor.com, and when it was sort of like you had to still stream it and it wasn't out in America yet. But I think that what's interesting is that was the same time that the second or the first Downey Jr. movie had come out the year prior. And the thing about that is that what I like about Sherlock, the BBC show, is it's the only adaptation, in general, that truly focuses on the idea that Watson is a writer. Mm. Right? Like, that's the one element that's missing. It's always mentioned, you know what I mean? In the Jeremy Brett adaptations, you know, Edward Hardwicke, who was the second Watson they had, was always scribbling things down. But those are the only ones that follow the plots. All other Sherlock Holmes adaptations don't follow the plots. They're just trying to capture the characters and the ideas. Even, like, you know, A Scandal in Belgravia, the BBC's, you know, the Cumberbatch answer to the famous Scandal in Bohemia story with Irena Adler. And I say Irena Adler because Jeremy Brett said Irena, not Irene. But I don't really know the right pronunciation. But
well, he's dead now. So.
He is dead, sadly. He was supposed to be James Bond? They almost cut Jeremy Brett. And he's in My Fair Lady? Did you know that?
I have often walked down the street before. Gosh. Yeah. Pavement never stayed between my feet. Does enchantment pour out of every door?
He was so handsome when he was so young. And, oh wow, Jeremy Brett! But
he was real handsome up until the last like 4 or 5 episodes that he filmed, and then you could tell that
he was
very
ill.
Yeah,
he was very, very ill. Yeah, I mean, but
and then it sort of
those ones are even those the adaptations are they'll change little things. There's one called the Musgrave Ritual, and in the text, it's like they're sitting in the 221B, and he's just like, "There's this case, Watson, of all these things you don't know about." And Watson's like, "That sucks. You want to tell me about that?" And so he tells him this story of the Musgrave Ritual. But in the even in the Granada 80s Jeremy Brett version, they, instead of that, they have them together, like going out, and they even that, and even in the most faithful ones, they had to change certain things to just make it work. I think that the reason why that the BBC one is the strongest is that it wants to incorporate, like, this, it updates the specifics. Watson is a blogger. You know, there's speeches that Cumberbatch delivers that are directly from the text. That's not the case in Elementary and the Downey Jr. films. You know, he'll say, like, the famous lines, like, "Eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." But people have been quoting that from, you know, Mr. Spock to the Doctor.
That's
on Doctor Who.
That's a pop culture thing at this point, rather
The thing that I like about Elementary, paradoxically, is because it works as a show almost independently of knowing who Sherlock Holmes is.
Yeah.
You know, as a procedural.
Falling into the grand tradition of American TV shows.
Exactly. You know, it is a procedural. It doesn't really have an overall arc, but, like, last season they handled the Irene Adler thing really amazingly. They handled the Moriarty thing awesomely. And I thought that it really worked with playing with all the bits of, you know, all the bits of canon without sort of being slavish. Because I think that where I sort of have issues with Sherlock is there are points where I'm like, oh, he's gearing up to make a speech. And in some ways that lessens the television experience of it for me, even though I know intellectually that I'm watching a Sherlock Holmes adaptation and that he is going to give a speech because that's kind of his thing. But, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't watched a lot of Elementary, and I watched the first couple episodes, and I wasn't taken with it, but I did like the little thing of, like, him keeping bees on the roof, you know what I mean? Because that's, like, that's just a really weird reference to the fact that, you know, he ends up keeping bees in his retirement, and, like, so I like little things like that, and I like, you know, I live in New York City, and I love New York City, so I like that it's New York City, but, I guess they're going to London in the new season.
They spend the first three episodes there.
Okay, yeah.
I think.
But, yeah, I don't know. I think that my reaction to it was sort of like, he didn't seem quite right for the character. And Johnny Lee Miller is obviously, like, a really, really, I mean, we know that Johnny Lee Miller is where we get Sean Connery impressions from, right? Trainspotting. You know, that's, like, he's the original. And he's great. You know, he's a great actor. But I think that, I just think that there was something about, when I remember Sherlock was coming out, and I thought Martin Freeman as Watson, perfect. And I was like, "Who's this Cumberbatch guy?" And I was he looks so goofy. And then, of course, you know, and his voice, he reminds people. I would say this, and people disagree with me, but I really think that he reminds me of Jeremy Brett, which to me was my Holmes.
He's got those. He's got the plummy tones. I mean, he has that very, very crisp enunciation.
And he's funny. He's funny. I think that my thing with Cumberbatch and Jeremy Brett is that they're funny. And after I saw Jeremy Brett adaptations, like, I think late 90s, early aughts, I saw those, and whenever I would read my Sherlock Holmes books, I was like, it's Jeremy Brett. And even, like, sci-fi stories that have Sherlock Holmes in them, you know, I'm always like, you know, that's who I see for some reason. Partly because it was the first one that I'd seen where he didn't wear the hat.
Yeah.
Where he could just wear whatever he wanted.
I love that the Deerstalker became a joke in the second season of Sherlock.
Yeah,
he just
pulls it off. It's like a
death frisbee.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
It's called
Earflash. We could literally talk about Sherlock Holmes forever.
Yeah,
but
we could also talk about how terrible the Robert Downey Jr. movies are.
I actually really like them.
I like them as movies
completely divorced from... I also really love Independence Day. So, I mean, they're big, dumb, loud movies that are a lot of fun to watch.
I'll tell you.
And have very little to do with actual. Amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, Sherlock Holmes is... I think that my final analysis of Sherlock Holmes is that it is an example of that we've always been taking him out of context, you know, since the early adaptations. And I think that sometimes that generally works better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I guess that brings us to the sort of giant impending elephant in the adaptation room, which is Ender's Game.
Yes.
Which I feel like is a controversial as an adaptation for reasons completely beyond the subject material.
Yeah.
Rightly so. But yeah, have you thought about Ender's Game as a movie and how that's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I personally, like, I was never huge on the Ender's books. the Ender books when I was younger, and I think that there was something, which is weird, because I really do, when it comes to science fiction and fantasy, I generally prefer science fiction, and I like spaceships and stuff like that. I think that the sort of conceit of Ender's Game was never super compelling to me. And I think that there's something about, I don't know if it works as a movie, because I feel like that, like, anyone who's read the book is excited to see those characters, and I think that casting looks amazing. I mean, yes. Asa Butterfield is I think great casting, and it looks like an amazing cast, but it looks sort of like, Ender's Game looks like a pretty safe Hollywood movie to me. It looks like here are a lot of really famous people. I mean, you watch the trailer and it's like Academy Award winner Ben Kingsley, you know, Harrison Ford, you know, and it's just like, it feels very safe to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm also sort of like, when it comes to those kinds of stories being adapted, I'm like, I don't know, like, hero rising, unlikely hero, massive overwhelming odds, like, ultimately, like, it'll be successful, but the specifics of it, I don't know, for some reason I'm just not all that interested. Like, I feel like that, like, whatever it does, it'll do bombastically, and it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, but I wonder, I'm not, I guess that, like, there's not a sacredness for that text to me that can be violated, you know? Yeah. Like, I'm just like, I'm sure it will be popcorn-y, which is very similar to how I feel about the book. Some of the other books, I think Ender's Shadow, I think, are a little bit more interesting for me.
The way that I sort of feel about it is that, you know, sort of for me, when I was reading it, I was actually assigned it in eighth grade, and I was like,
many of us were, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Best assignment ever.
Well, you know, for me, the big sort of, everyone here's read it, and we're okay spoiling one of the most famous, it's one of the most famous, I feel like if people haven't read it, then, like, you just stop listening now,
or go read it.
Skip forward, like, maybe 2 minutes. But, you know, that moment at the end when he finds out that it wasn't a simulation, and that he's fighting, that what he's been shooting at are not just, like, figures on a screen, but in fact have been, like, real ships and real people, and that when his friends have gotten, like, killed, that's actually happening. That, for me, was really sort of, like, moving. And then in the trailers, it makes it look like he always knows.
Which I think is the only way to do it, because otherwise you have... because that was the thing that was always bothered me about the book, is I feel like I saw that twist coming. And maybe it was just, like, watching way too much Twilight Zone or, like, reading a bunch of other science fiction. I felt like I was like, this is, you know, science fiction writing 101, and everybody thinks that they're like, I got a twist ending. You know what I mean? Like, that's always, it's like, it turns out he's actually a peacock dinosaur, you know? And you've been living in the, you know, like, flip it around, you know? Yeah. And I think the Ender's Game is sort of that. I think that as an adaptation, it was the only way they could do it. You know what I mean? Like, I think that having it, because otherwise then you have a Sixth Sense ending that everybody already knows, and I think that...
The problem is that
how do you write this?
That changes the interpretation of Ender's character, though, is that if he's... because all along, the whole concept is that he doesn't really know his own strength, or that he's sort of extraordinary, and he's just... Or he figures it out along the way, but he doesn't realize he's killing people. And so that's what makes the ending so traumatizing for him, and what actually... Well, I suppose this doesn't matter so much for the movie, but it's what sets up the rest of the series.
Well, and all, I mean, also it changes the arc of how he learns to sort of be the hero, be the unlikely hero. Mm. You're not really an unlikely hero if you're doing the thing that's expected of you,
and if you're killing and if people you know from about, a distance,
and if you know about it.
Yeah.
But all the things you guys have just mentioned are kind of narrative problems in Ender's Game that, like, present a problem for adaptation. You can't have in a film, like, maybe in an episode of a television show you could do this that was ongoing, but you can't have in a film a character performing actions which are later rendered to be meaningless, and doing things that have...
rendered meaningless?
I think that what I mean is that, like, Ender's actions are, like, inherently low stakes immediately. It's a film. It's a big adventure film. You can't have his actions be like he's in school.
But at the same time, you're also setting up... I mean, and also, like, the movie hasn't come out, so, you know, the things that I'm responding to could actually just be, like, simulated images, and he's like, still thinks he's in a game. But, I mean, you're
the trailer's
also...
fake. Like, yeah, I've always wanted that to be, like, where the trailer is not anything, you know?
It's a quiet character piece of, like, him and Ben Kingsley in a room talking about power.
I always want that. I saw a tweet from a comedian today. It was just, like, after the X-Men trailer came out, and he was sort of like, pitch for a movie, 90 minutes of Patrick Stewart staring in a mirror. You know, like,
my sister called it, you know, Feelings with Superheroes, the film. Yeah. But I mean,
that's an adaptation too, though.
I just feel like you also couldn't get a movie audience who isn't familiar with the books, because the bulk of the movie audience is probably not going to be, they're pitching it like a big sci-fi tentpole movie. So I'm going to imagine that like at least half the audience will not have read Ender's Game and will not have, you know, thought about this. And then if you are setting it up to be like, this is a child and he is going into this situation, like deliberately killing stuff.
Yeah, that
I feel like that also just sets up like a moral sort of like, and that's why it's so fucked up in the books when you find out that he's been doing it all along and he didn't know it.
And he's like,
because all of his training is like, when you're an adult, this is what you're gonna do.
Yeah.
When, just kidding, you're 12 and you just massacred like millions of people.
Only way to actually make it work for the audience and to still have you root for the character is to make it a sort of dramatic irony situation where the audience knows what's happening, as in the case of the adults in Ender's life, but Ender himself doesn't know, which means that you're sitting there watching him and he's like shrugging off everything.
Which will be interesting to see with Catching Fire, because there's a similar, you know, massive spoiler for Catching Fire that does not involve the fake ghost of Seneca Crane. Is that obviously
whatever, the ghost of Seneca Crane is real.
I think Bridget brings up, that's a really good idea, is like the idea of having dramatic irony. And I think that the reason for that is what I was just going to say, is that there's like a theatrical quality to screenplays. You know, what does it play? You know, in like a novel, you don't have to actually have things happen. You can have people just thinking about things. You know, that's part of why we read novels, because, you know, we don't necessarily need it to be just plot. This isn't science fiction or fantasy, but one of the big arguments I get into about adaptations is Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. I don't know if you guys have read it.
Book and movie.
So I don't like the film. It's a beautiful film, and the reason I don't like No Country for Old Men is because it is not about the old man who there is no country for. Because in the novel, there's these direct addresses to the reader that the sheriff character is talking to the reader, which you can do in a novel, and the Coen brothers, correctly when writing the screenplay, were like, we can't do that, because we can't have voiceover, and it's going to be crazy, and it'll be weird.
The same way that in The Hunger Games, you can't have
Katniss talking to you. Right.
It's such an interior book.
Right, precisely, and I think that this is where this relates kind of sideways to Ender's Game, is that you have to decide, like, when you're writing the screenplay, of like how easy you're going to make it for the audience. And I think that novels aren't deciding whether or not it's going to be easy for the reader or not. They're deciding, and in many ways, they're more personal experiences in that way. And so I think that the agency that characters have to have in films, even if they're being adapted from things that are really, really complex, has to be really clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, you know, an evolving agency like Ender's, or an evolving realization like Katniss's, or a rumination on philosophy like the sheriff character in No Country for Old Men, doesn't play in screenplays. And so a lot of times those elements are eliminated in favor of, like, plots, mm-hmm. you know? And that being said, is I think that No Country for Old Men was the only adaptation they could have done.
Yeah.
I don't think that, like, that my dream adaptation doesn't exist, because it would require telepathic signals to the audience of, like, this is what Tommy Lee Jones is thinking right now. You know?
Some kind of strange
subtitles.
Right.
Well, has there ever been an adaptation of something, either that you loved or that you were sort of indifferent to, that just filled you with blind rage of, like, missed opportunities?
Oh, gosh. There's got to be. There must be something. I mean, the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Okay, that's legit. I mean, I'm with you there.
And I think the reason why is because I found it to be on paper more faithful to the tone of Dahl,
and the tone and the facts
of the book. And I love the Gene Wilder version, but I mean, I never was one of those kids who loved it. Like, I didn't love it. I was always like, it wasn't weird enough for me. You know what I mean?
Probably the only person in the history of the world who has ever said that.
Well, I mean, it wasn't weird in the right way. The tone of weirdness wasn't like, it's like the note was off. It wasn't being played right. So I would say that was, and so then I was like, oh, Johnny Depp, to like Tim Burton, this is actually probably a good move. And then it wasn't. It was just like the potential there was like, these are the right people, this is the right way to take the script. But then it was such an unwatchable film. It was so mortifyingly bad.
I felt the same way, and this is probably not something that either of you have seen and or read, but I am a really big fan of Cassandra Clare's Mortal Instruments series.
I have read them.
I ignored all the warnings that said that this was going to be a fucking terrible shit show of a film. I was like, oh, he's directed Karate Kid 2, the remake of Karate Kid.
This is the one with James.
Yeah, he directed that. Yeah. Well,
no karate. No karate in that movie. There's no karate in Karate Kid.
Yeah, so it's just a lie.
And you have a movie with Rush Hour. What's his name?
Jackie Chan.
Jackie Chan. You have a movie in which Jackie Chan cries and washes a car and doesn't do enough cool martial arts. That movie is the worst.
Oh my god.
Anyway,
okay.
Sorry, so continue.
That guy. And it had a really good cast on paper. I was like, if I was going to cast this, like, these are a bunch of very attractive, decent actors.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a decent effects budget. It's going to be fine. It was a hot, stinking mess of a movie. And it just did not work at all. But if you had told, all the information I had going in was, I like the book, I like the actors and the director. I like the actors, and then I didn't know anything about the director, and I was just like, oh, shit, this is the worst.
Yeah, I think that if I think about Blind Rage, like, mostly because a book that I was really attached to that's contemporary was, I really hated the Series of Unfortunate Events movie.
Yeah.
That was a really terrible film, and I could, like, even from the poster, the kids were like, why is Klaus not wearing glasses?
All the sort of, like, there's all these moments of sort of quiet sort of joy and discovery in those books that was totally removed to give Jim Carrey the opportunity to, like, make faces.
And also, there was also elements that were added in. Like, in a book that's full of complex, like, sort of clues about what has really happened to the Baudelaire's parents, and, like, they're like, oh, we're going to give them this spyglass. It's like, well, why do you need that? You know, like, there's another one, Philip Pullman film.
Oh, my God.
You know, that was a disaster.
Well, I have my own feelings about that series. But, has there ever been a sequel to the Series of Unfortunate Events movie? They've never made any of the other
movies,
the
first
right?
film is the first three books.
Okay, but they've never made the other ones.
Yeah, they kind of spun them together. No, they never did. And I wonder about that. And I wonder, but the thing is about that, again, it's such an, like, I like that Bridget's interior. Like, those are, you have a narrator who is the author, but who is a fictional character,
mm-hmm.
who is pursuing them. So the narrative conceit of that is already really weird for a movie. You know, it's not like Harry Potter, where it's like a close third, like, easy sort of thing to adapt, you know. But yeah, I mean, that was one that I was angry mostly just because I love those books so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they're massively underrated. You know, it's like, no matter how many people say that they love Series of Unfortunate Events, it's not enough for me. You know, like,
your love is insufficient.
Well, it's like, yeah, and I think that it's because it's such a challenging series. There's so many books, but they're so funny and they're so intelligent and they're so much better. They're so much more intelligent than their contemporaries. And so I think that the film adaptation was poised to just at least get you excited about the books. And in the end, it was just like, what am I watching?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's, I felt the same way about the Mortal Instruments. I mean, the whole thing about the Mortal Instruments, as we can spoil, you know, the whole series. The whole thing about the Mortal Instruments.
Change the name of the podcast. We ruin things you haven't read.
The whole point of the Mortal Instruments is that the main character falls in love with this character, this guy who it later turns out in the first book, is her brother. She thinks it's her brother. She's like 100% convinced for like three books that she totally has a lady boner for this guy that is related to her. And there's some really convincing reasons in the book for why she would think that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's a lot of character development that would have been so easy. Like, not like complicated stuff.
Yeah.
So easy. But in the movie, one character says to the evil dad, hey, why don't we just tell them that they're brother and sister?
Wow.
Totally fall for it.
Wow.
It was,
they're complete idiots. Because they're teenagers. What more can we expect of them?
Ah, seriously. And, I mean, so that happened. This is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and his, like, evil villain weave.
God, he's everywhere right now.
He's
everywhere. Back.
I know. My sister says that Dracula is really good. I haven't really brought myself.
That is sister, I think, is the only person in America that thinks that.
Yeah. Well, my sister and I also have a really high tolerance for camp, so we tend to like things. We also sort of recognize, like, this is very campy.
I remember the joke that I was making when I saw the first Dracula trailer. I was like, oh, it's Jonathan Rhys Meyers and Dracula? I'm sure they're going to play that straight. That's going to be, like, Bram Stoker's going to be like, yeah. You know?
I mean, speaking of current current television adaptations. Are you watching Sleepy Hollow?
No, I'm not. You know, I was just in real Sleepy Hollow this past weekend, I have to say. And you want to talk about how little people understand about source material versus, like I saw what I would consider to be a live adaptation of something, which is, like, a haunted house that was supposedly, like, Sleepy Hollow themed.
Oh, my God.
And yet there was these people doing these terrible... Bela Lugosi impersonations, which they don't even know is Bela Lugosi. They're just doing the Count. A scary voice is just like a bad Transylvania accent, which is just a shadow of like Boris and Natasha, like Natasha, like one. I just drop articles from things, you know, like, and it's I don't know. I can't comment on Sleepy Hollow.
We made Russian accents, fake Russian accents last week when Cece was telling us about she dressed up as Molotov cocktails from Venture Brothers for Comic-Con this year. So
among many things, I imagine Cece dressed up as. no, I haven't watched Sleepy Hollow. Everybody seems to love it, though.
I was honestly surprised by how much I liked it. It's just. It is camp. It's just it's completely self-aware.
It's camp that knows it's camp. Yes. And one of the things, one of the points that I think I was trying to make slash was making it badly earlier about Sherlock is that. One of the things I like about Sleepy Hollow and the way that Elementary has, and actually Sherlock too, is that they've captured in a modern way what it means to be like a friend and a colleague.
Yes.
In a way that not a lot of shows do. Because so many TV shows are about the romance and like, I'm staring at you and that means that later we're going to make out in like six episodes when it sweeps, we're going to have to like kiss and it's going to be a thing to get ratings.
That's all Terra Nova was.
Exactly. Don't even talk to me about Terra Nova. I was so excited for the show. I was like, fucking Dinosaur. Oh my God. I hated that show so much.
I'm the only person that likes it.
I lasted two episodes and I was like, this is the dumbest waste of potential that I've ever seen.
There's
in my
life. There's a giant Tyrannosaurus running toward a time portal in the series finale. Just saying. It's really cool. What about when that little girl gets her ankylosaurus taken away? It was so sad.
Ugh, whatever.
Sorry. off track. You can cut that.
Yeah. We probably won't.
We
live in a lot of shit.
Do we really need that? No, but it's fun.
but you know, one of the great things is that everyone, I think, loves about the Sherlock Holmes stories, and one of the reasons why people have been, I think, so fast and loose with the actual plot stories is because people want that banter between Sherlock and Watson. And that's what I think Sherlock captures really well. I think that Elementary captures it really well.
Because so few adaptations of Sherlock Holmes have actually made Watson any sort of equal to Holmes.
Or have him give any kind of, like, pushback.
Yeah.
Although the Russian one, actually. There's a really great Russian adaptation from
the 80s. I've heard this. I'll have to defend the Jeremy Brett adaptations again, because they are almost word for word the text. Mm. And so at that point, Watson's rendered correctly. You know, like, so, I mean, like, to be fair, but the Jeremy Brett ones are just, for whatever reason, not as famous. Mm-hmm. And they weren't on the BBC. They were on Granada television, you know. So I think that has something to do with it. But... that's what I would say. But we are on Sherlock Holmes again. I wanted to ask you guys another question about adaptations that I'm interested in is what about things that people think are adapted from something, but they're not? Because I can think of two examples.
Oh. Please give us your examples.
Yeah, well, I'm not prepared for this question.
Most famous example was, and most people I think know that this isn't the case now, but in the 90s, when like the late 90s, when I was working in bookstores in Arizona where I'm from, people would ask me where the Star Wars books were that Star Wars was based on.
Oh, now, this is I could see that.
But the reason why that misconception exists is because there was a novel there was a novel released in 1976 before Star Wars came out that was called Star Wars From the Adventures of Luke Skywalker, which was written by George Lucas. Now, it really wasn't written by George Lucas. It was written by Alan Dean Foster. It was a novelization of a screenplay that had not been finished filming yet. So for years, there was a lot of people who believed that there were Star Wars novels that the films were based on, which, you know, that this was a novel that George Lucas wrote and then he adapted it. And I think obviously most people know that that's not the case now, but I guarantee somewhere there's someone working at Barnes & Noble in the suburbs of America and someone has walked in and asked to see where all the Star Wars novels are written by George Lucas. You know, because
Of course, there's a whole giant
plenty of Star Wars novels,
of them, but
none of them are written by George Lucas. Not a single one was written by George Lucas. But I think that that's something that sort of... And actually, you gave me that for Christmas. You know, the Star Wars novels for Christmas. And there are so many things in those adaptations that are part of what we now think about. So, like, this adaptation actually created mythology that then the later films had to use, even though it's like a paradox. Like, where did that information come from? You know, like, it wasn't ever there. But there's another one that's not actually an adaptation that people think is. But
I think
if you guys have any.
Well, what I see more often is that people don't realize it's an adaptation. They think it's something that was created out of whole cloth, especially if it's sort of a mid-level indie type movie based on a YA novel. Most of those people don't realize were actually novels, because people don't pay attention to sort of quiet contemporary YA novels. The Spectacular Now was a book. What are the other ones? I was just talking to someone about them recently.
Well, the one that I was actually, I think we talked about it on this very podcast, I did not know that Practical Magic was a book before it was a movie.
By Alice Hoffman, who has had published, like,
Alice
20
Hoffman's
books.
A wonderful novelist.
She's fantastic.
I feel stupid now, that I know that, but I mean, that's one of those movies that for me exists perfectly as a thing, you know, even not knowing that.
Well, you know, the most famous one, and this is my favorite example where people say the book is better. I think we have to address that, right?
Okay.
The book is better. What about Jaws?
I've never read the book of Jaws.
Peter Benchley wrote Jaws.
Yep.
And like,
he wrote the screenplay for the movie too, or he half wrote the screenplay.
Right. I have a friend, my a very, very good friend of mine, who I've known since high school, who has only read the novel Jaws. Who has never seen, and I think he's the only person in the world who that's the case. But I mean, there's an example of one that, like, I think most people wouldn't realize was a novel. The Birds was a novel, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, there's stuff like that. My favorite one, though, is that Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick wrote 2001 together.
Oh.
And then Arthur C. Clarke had a novel, like, where it's just like people like, oh, this is this masterpiece of Arthur C. Clarke. It's like, no, it was a conspiracy. Like, he and Kubrick got together and were like, we're going to make a novel movie combo. And that's exactly what they did. And so there's obviously 2001 is a beautiful film, but I'm like, the source material, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, because
it was always
just
designed.
Both,
it was always designed to be a film. It was never like, you know, Kubrick was like, oh my gosh, look at this amazing, you know, like novel, you know, like where, you know, and I've written extensively about Philip K. Dick adaptations, but like, yeah, like, God, like, you know, that's totally a fake adaptation, like, based on the novel, which we wrote at the exact same time, to release at the exact same time.
Well,
you
I
know,
mean,
like,
well, I mean, I remember when I found the book Neverwhere, and I found out that had been written as a sort of fuck you to BBC television, because Neil Gaiman hated the way that they did the miniseries
sort of
so much.
Yeah.
Well, it's terrible, and it looks like they just sort
I mean,
of held
it's
up
also
some brick
like
walls and like
1990s BBC. They didn't have a lot of money to work with.
Yeah, that well, not ever really.
Yeah, I mean, like Doctor Who also looked the same until about 2009.
Yeah, until Matt Smith. I mean, you know, like it's
They just didn't have much money, so I don't hold that against them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, that's something that I think the novelization works better than the original, because it was originally a screenplay and then
I mean, I think that also with like it's interesting, like when it comes to people's knowledge of what isn't adapted, the joke that I always like to make is like, if there's a science fiction movie that's come out, there's the chances of it being a Philip K. Dick adaptation are like pretty much 98%. You know what I mean? Like, if you think about just like, you know, like the Adjustment Bureau,
yeah,
you know what I mean, or what was the last big Philip K. Dick adaptation?
iRobot.
iRobot's on Isaac Asimov.
Oh, right.
iRobot is actually a great example of an adaptation that has never been done. That's a wonderful example of an adaptation that can never be done correctly, because it is the exact opposite of the message of iRobot.
Yeah.
Which is the message of iRobot is that robots are nice and they will end up helping us. And every, like, because the whole reason that Asimov wrote the robot stories was because he was tired of robot stories that were Frankenstein stories.
Right.
Mm. So, of course, like, the iRobot adaptation was just like, so the robots go crazy, right?
You know? Of course.
Like, it's the first thing they're doing. Like, and then there's going to be, it's like,
I'm a little embarrassed that I thought that was Philip K. Dick.
No, there was, what was the one?
I'm just going to blame my aphasia.
No, there was
I knew it was Asimov.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
What was the one big Philip K. Dick adaptation that came out recently? Gosh, I'm really blanking. The Adjustment Bureau
is the one with Tom Cruise.
Oh, no, no, no. Total Recall. The Total Recall, the Colin Farrell. Okay.
I didn't see
which
that
Which is
one.
Total Recall is a We Can Remember It For You Wholesale is the show. Yeah. Well, that. Philip K. Dick short stories. There we go. Short stories that are based on the film.
Yeah.
Almost every Philip K. Dick, well, half anyway, are always short stories. Minority Report is a short story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, those ones are, I mean, like, the faithfulness is almost never. Never yeah. are those faithful to the Philip K. Dick stories, but oftentimes they're very entertaining films. Whether they're good or not is sort of, I mean, like, if Blade Runner had been faithful to Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, I mean, there's no way it would have been as popular as it was. I mean, that's one of the most, and, like, Philip K. Dick is famously, like, has clunky prose and really, like,
bless his heart.
Well, but the characters in Philip K. Dick stories are always so hilarious to me because they're always sort of, like, one guy who knows everything or doesn't know anything, you know, and it's sort of, you know, always the same thing. But yeah, I mean, like, you think about how there's an example of, like, Ridley Scott, who is not the most, you know, deep, profound human being on the planet, being like, we're gonna make this movie, and then, like, what a classic science fiction movie that's also an adaptation, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think this is actually some of the best adaptations get made from short stories, because since there's no real fan base around most short stories, they don't feel the need to be exactly correct or faithful to every single detail of the story. And there's not too much plot to cram into an hour and a half long movie.
They're a little shorter, and it's easier to sort of, like, maneuver, I think.
Yeah. What short story would you guys want to see adapted into a film? Because I often always like thinking of the idea of contemporary short stories being adapted into, like, miniseries.
The
you know?
One yeah. the one that,
like,
I'm thinking
like
of right
Dennis
now.
Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son was, you know, adapted, you know.
I don't know what kind of movie this. It would probably be one of those, like, really weird, you know, it would be, like, one of those really, like, weird, unwatchable Lars von Trier films, but Elizabeth Baer had a short story about a war robot on a beach collecting, like, pieces of glass and making, like, memorial, like, medals for her, like, fallen human comrades.
Oh, God.
And it was super depressing, and then this sort of, like, little homeless kid comes along, and, like, the robot knows that it's sort of, like, falling apart, and...
Oh.
You know, but it had these beautiful visuals of this robot sitting on this beach, like, making stuff, and then this little, I don't know, that would be my thing. And that really cute short story that was on tor.com today.
Oh my God, yes.
if you haven't...
Marmalade and Brimstone by Aaron Corwin.
Well,
oh my God,
which
actually,
so adorable. I pulled out of the slush.
Hey,
10 points, Bridget.
No conflict of interest of wanting to see that adapted.
It's... It's really adorable.
I did not know that she did that, but
it's just
hunger.
It's like a super cute.
Can we say the author of the story?
Aaron Corwin.
You're welcome.
To all 80 of our followers are now going to go read your story.
That's assuming that all 80 people who follow us on Twitter
who aren't
our friends
adorable,
or our coworkers,
and it's going to be an amazing film someday.
It's going to be like
promise.
The Marley and Me of, like, child stories.
It's this very straightforward, like...
Don't make me do the Owen Wilson impression.
Do it! Do it!
What about the dog?
What about the demon?
What kind of wine are we having?
This is Yellowtail Pinot Grigio. We've moved on. But I would say that Elizabeth Baer short story, whose name I have shamefully forgotten.
Bridget, a short story that you want
to
see?
Oh, God. I don't even know. I can't actually call any to mind right now.
I can think of a book that I would want to see a movie of.
Ooh, do share.
Sabriel.
Okay.
I want to see a movie of Sabriel, because I feel like it has a lot of the hallmarks of sort of, like, the Percy Jackson kind of thing of, like, the young kid.
There's
you know?
Another one, rage-inducing adaptation.
I never read the books, so I never saw the movies.
The books
so...
Very charming.
That is the word for them. They're charming. I'm charmed by those books.
They're fun
but,
to read.
But the adaptation looked like something that was going to make me want to punch things.
Yeah.
So I was just like I'll just not.
All of a sudden, they're no longer 12. They're like 17.
Yeah.
Like, this story gets a lot less interesting when you make it about teenagers.
I just feel like the
like
lights
children.
Were on in that movie. Like, it felt like everything was way too bright. Like, it was just like...
But then you have something like... the really shameful adaptation of Avatar The Last Airbender, where it was
which
like the lights
see.
Were off,
yeah.
which you saved $3, $15
well,
in your sanity
but that's
by
an,
not
but that's
seeing
an
it.
But that's an interesting concept because of, you know, like, there's because that's like an adaptation of a TV show.
Yeah.
Like, that's a different kind of adaptation, you know what I mean? Like, which is interesting. Which is,
and it was interesting that it was such a failure, because you would think that having it already be in a medium for screen, it would be... Whatever.
Well, I will
tamp down my anger about Avatar The Last Airbender.
Sometimes bad movies fail, and we rejoice in the market.
but no, I mean, I really think that Sabriel is one of those books that I've always wanted to see a movie of, because it's sort of cool, and it's got magic and dead people and a river that raises the dead and bells and magic and boarding schools in England. post-World War I. I mean, it's got all my, like, all my high points of literature. So
well, that's, I mean, you know, hopefully it'll happen. And that's where I'm at with The Magicians, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, come on. I mean, like, I know that there was, I mean, Lev's a good buddy of mine, but I mean, like, so I'm totally biased, but, like, come on, The Magicians? Why is that? Like, who's, I know that there was some deals with, like, miniseries stuff, but, like, if you did The Magicians, like, big budget, like, that would be so dope. Like, that would be, it would change everything, I think, if it was a really well done film, like in terms of like what those kinds of fantasy movies could do, because it's like sex and drinking and like, you know, like it's
like the Animal House of the fantasy world.
Just when they turn into animals and have sex with each other, I mean, come on, like it's so good. Like that's gonna be like they turn into foxes and it's sort of like,
actually,
oh,
haven't
come
read
on.
It, so.
Everyone, spoiler alert: there's a point where Quentin turns into a fox and has sex with someone who is also a fox, and it's also the first time he has sex as a fox. Oh my god, such a good book.
Well, I mean, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is
that's happening. Yeah, that's happening.
You know, that's one of the things where, like, I'm
terrified.
I'm so excited. I'm so scared. I'm so excited. I'm so scared, because it could be awesome or it could be like really objectively terrible.
Yeah,
and I haven't decided.
I think that making it a miniseries is a step in the right direction, though.
Oh yeah, because it's such a long,
so many pages. We got really far away from short stories, huh, guys?
The exact.
This is our podcast. We can do what we want.
I like, that little power play of mine didn't really work out.
No.
Well, I mean, we actually have like a thing in our agency clause that says that short stories authors are on their own, so we literally don't handle them. Well, because we figure that they have,
even if there's like movie interest.
Well, that we'd come in on.
Okay,
but,
yeah,
but
it's not worth it for us to take the commission.
I'm going
to
take commission on your $50 that you got for selling that story.
That's
like,
not worth it for me. It's too much to take away from that. And
I feel like one of those dudes behind a ledger cackling and counting coins.
Yeah,
like,
and it also, agents don't
How
actually...
many of those dudes do you know?
I watch a lot of Dickens adaptations, okay?
Ooh, Dickens adaptations, that's fun. I love A Christmas Carol.
Can I tell you what my favorite adaptation of A Christmas Carol is?
You can.
Muppet Christmas Carol.
It's the best one.
It's the best one.
It's the best one.
Yeah.
It's the best one. It's
because it's got a narrator.
And also, yeah, Charles Dickens is in
also
it.
Also jokes.
And also Michael Caine.
No. He's the best Scrooge. Surely I've told Bridget my idea for the Christmas Carol sequel blockbuster movie.
I think you did, but I... No,
Tiny Tim? did I tell you about this? I told you this, I'm sure.
I think so, yes.
At some point. People that are friends with me have to listen to all my bad ideas. I want to do an action movie that's Tiny Tim he's grown up. And he uses the crutch as like a staff that he fights with, and his catchphrase is "suck my Dickens." and when he blows things up, he says "God bless us, everyone." It's like
and walks away and slow
motion. It's like Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunter, only it's Tiny Tim, and then
I beg the internet to make this happen. I beg you.
Michael Caine inexplicably just reprises his role as Scrooge, who's gone evil for no reason again. Like the day after Christmas, it's just like. They're just like Scrooge went evil again, and like Tiny Tim is fighting for justice.
But wouldn't Scrooge be the kindly? No, he's the kindly mentor figure who dies to give Tiny Tim his purpose.
Well, I gotta work on that, because in the trailer it's like Mr. Scrooge wants his money, and then like Tiny Tim's like leave him alone, you know, and then Tiny Tim has to like beat up these thugs that are like beating up like a poor person, and then he says "suck my Dickens" after he. So
I'm sure you could make something
happen.
I gotta
work on that. I just like the idea of
it's like Jane Austen Fight Club.
Oh my god, Jane Austen Fight Club! Talk about the most genius adaptation of anything ever.
You read my review of Austen Land, right, Bridget?
Yes,
I haven't read Austen Land, but I heard
it's an enjoyable book.
An adaptation, but that film is an adaptation of a book that's a pastiche of That rabbit hole is really scary.
But then you think if we're gonna go down the British lit rabbit hole very briefly, you know, Clueless is one of the best.
Oh my god, yes,
one of the best pieces of interpretation and adaptation ever.
Absolutely,
you know, I wasn't going to say it because I thought we'd moved on from the contemporary adaptations, but
we
never have to talk
about anything in this podcast.
My Emma's my favorite Jane Austen novel, and Clueless is my favorite adaptation of Emma.
Yeah,
it's
period.
Perfect.
The character of Emma Woodhouse is best personified in Cher. The character Cher. We understand that Cher is the character's name, not the singer. Cher, you believe in love, Cher. Cher, Alicia Silverstone's character, who is Emma Woodhouse in Clueless. Yeah, I mean, and Elton is such a good... I mean, all the parallels are so good in it. And
the parallels are perfect, but, like, not too precise, which makes it
work. I remember I had read Emma, and I didn't sort of realize it until it was pointed out to me, and I was like, oh, fucking course it's Emma!
See, I hadn't read Emma before I saw Clueless, but then when I was reading Emma, I got about halfway through, I was like, oh my god,
this is
Clueless!
The thing is that, like, I'm a little bit older than you guys, so Clueless came out, I was in high school.
Okay.
So I saw Clueless in the theater in high school. So like you're in middle school?
Yeah.
Okay, right. So I'm reading like the time you're supposed to be reading Jane Austen, right? For the first time. So for me, I didn't realize it until later either. And I was just like, oh, that's why I love that movie. And I quote that movie so often. That movie is really, 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 really good.
He's a disco dancing, Oscar Wilde reading, Streisand ticket holding in front of Dorothy.
Well, that same idea, he has that line where he shaves his head and he's like, you know, why didn't you shave your head? I'm keeping it real. And then he says it two other times, once to himself.
I'm keeping it real.
Like, he says it to himself. Like,
Don't call my mom.
Oh my god, that is... No, but that movie, I've watched it recently. I don't know if you guys have... I've seen it in the past 6 months.
It comes
months.
On MTV sometimes.
Yeah. It's on Any Netflix. Time. I just watch it. Like, it's really good.
But while we're talking about Clueless, also, 10 Things I Hate About You, probably the best Taming of the Shrew ever.
We haven't talked about Shakespeare at all.
No.
That's okay.
Well, we can touch on it briefly.
I'm sure that there's entire podcasts developed to talking about Shakespeare.
Yeah, I don't think they need us.
I mean, yeah, I think that my thing is that, like, I like 10 Things I Hate About You, and that was around the same time that Clueless came out. And
the 90s movies for teen girls.
I think that was a little later, though, because I think Clueless was 1996.
Okay,
so I lied. I was actually in elementary school. But 10 Things I Hate About You was like in the 2000s because it had all that amazing 2000s fashion and music, like Letters to Cleo.
Well, the funny thing about, I mean, again, Shakespeare adaptations, again, there's probably a whole, I mean, talk about, you know, in a Sherlock Holmes sort of parallel, talk about something that at this point it's more normal for a Shakespeare adaptation to not be in its historical setting. Like, it's like,
it starts to feel, like, stuffy if
it's
like proper.
It's like it's like there's that one, there's a wonderful adaptation of Macbeth at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn right now that's an all-female Macbeth. It's like, okay. And of course it's also set in a women's prison.
Oh no, that's Julius Caesar.
I'm seeing that on Saturday. Why did I say Macbeth? Because I like saying Macbeth because you're not supposed
to say it. Well, I wanted to curse us.
I wanted to say it, yeah.
Well, there's also a Macbeth that's going on with David Tennant.
That's right.
But yeah, I'm really excited about that.
But yeah, but I mean...
Harriet Walter!
But like Shakespeare adaptations, like it's almost like, you know, like what's the most famous, you know, Shakespeare adaptation that is not an overt Shakespeare adaptation? West Side Story. West Side Story is the most famous, you know, and it was directed by Robert Wise, by the way, who directed The Day the Earth Stood Still and the first Star Trek movie. So
half written by Stephen Sondheim.
Yep. So, I mean, but, you know, West Side Story, I mean, come on. Like, that's like the ultimate, like, best version of Romeo and Juliet that you can imagine. And again, singing.
Yeah.
Also, you know, tap dancing.
and only one person dying at the end instead of two, you know? I still encounter people. I mean, I'm sure that you guys all had a good English teacher in high school, but I still encounter people that are like, "Oh, I didn't know West Side Story was writing students of mine." Well, they like really, and I'm like,
that's a thing.
There's a secret one though. That's a secret adaptation, you know.
Kind of secret.
I think it's reached the point where so many people know about it that no one talks about it as an adaptation. So people, it's like sort of its own thing.
It's a thing on its own,
It's a squeakquel. It's like a whatever.
Was that a chipmunks pun?
I've appropriated Squeakle to mean anything that's not.
I think we might have to deduct points for that.
The way I use Squeakle is to say that anything that is not exactly a pastiche, that's not exactly an adaptation, that's somehow related.
Yeah.
You know, like Prometheus is a Squeakle. Of aliens. Yeah. It's not really a prequel.
The trailer being different from the movie. Like, let's talk about how different the marketing for Prometheus was from the actual film of Prometheus. We're watching Prometheus going, what am I watching? What's happening right now?
I'm probably the only defender. There's a secretly good movie inside of Prometheus that I just waiting to burst out of its body.
The only thing I want to watch is Michael Fassbender's head and Noomi Rapace have adventures in space.
Will probably happen in the sequel.
I will totally go see that. I did not like Prometheus.
I just want to see the buddy comedy of Michael Fassbender's body.
I love both of them so much. It's like, yeah, I'm so great. Fine with it.
Yeah, so great.
But yeah, I don't know. Shakespeare is obviously something that could. I mean, you know, I liked the Doctor Who Shakespeare episode. That's one of my favorite Shakespeare adaptations. Mm-hmm. Not a real Shakespeare adaptation.
And their A Christmas Carol was also excellent.
Oh, that, you know, I get into so many arguments with that. I love that. I love their Christmas Carol.
That is the only episode. Well, there are probably a couple episodes of New Who that my father has seen, and that was the only one that I watched with him. And it was, like, on Christmas night, and so we're, like, watching the replay. And I'd already seen it, my sister had already seen it, and we both really liked it, and we were like, I hope he likes it, but he doesn't react to things. So we got to the end, and the episode ended and moved on, and my dad sits back and goes, that was really great! And I was like, yes!
Well, what I love about that, I love a lot of things about that. One is that, you know, that we in television criticism, we all know the phrase jumping the shark, and we know that it comes from Happy Days when the Fonz jumps over sharks. But in that episode, they were just like, he's going to ride a shark. We're just going to get this out of the way right now. And I remember when I wrote the review of it for Tortugan, it was like, the Doctor rides the shark on Christmas.
The
other thing I liked about that is, like, one of the things I love so much about A Christmas Carol and all adaptations of it is that A Christmas Carol invented literary time travel that wasn't a device, but that ghosts were the vehicle of time and space travel.
Yeah.
And so with Doctor Who, they were like, well, how do we do that as a science fiction thing? And so they actually had a time traveler. Those ghosts are time travelers.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing, if I reread A Christmas Carol every year at Christmas, and the, like, before, not on Christmas Day, I talk to people on Christmas Day.
I can't open presents right now. I'm reading A Christmas Carol.
I have to read Charles Dickens.
Mom, leave me alone. I'm reading.
But usually when I'm given books for Christmas, the
effects of time travel in Dickens in Christmas Carol are so cool, because, like, he takes Scrooge back in time, you know, the Ghost of Christmas Past, and then Scrooge is like, I have pimples, because he's, like, back in time. And, like, I thought the way the Doctor Who episode handled that, and how audacious to call it A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not, you know, like, and have it be like this, like, guy on some other planet. But I thought that the way it handled it, by being its literal time travel, it's literally changing it, whereas, like, Dickens was just beginning all of that, the time travel as sort of moral, ethical parable. You know what I mean? And like how they, that's like with Doctor Who, it was like, it's just so fitting. Yeah, no, that's a wonderful sideways adaptation of A Christmas Carol. And yeah, like, one I would watch over and over again.
We do watch the Muppet Christmas Carol one literally every year on Christmas.
So do I. Yeah.
You know, I mean, the songs are so great, but the way that they incorporate the original language, like, the fact that Gonzo and Rizzo,
Charles Dickens, you mean?
Are, yeah, well, Gonzo as Charles Dickens, are, you know, he's giving the narration, you know, and then Rizzo is sort of the audience stand-in, like, responding to the narration. I mean, it works on so many levels. I remember I wrote a paper in college once about how it was the best adaptation.
Well, I wrote, Christmas, we did, there was a Muppet Week we did at Tor.com, like, when the new Muppet movie was coming out, and I did two Muppet movies, one of which was the Christmas Carol, which I think the title of the article is Candy Cane. I just love that
Scrooge is, like, this old Cockney asshole.
I really do, as we said before, I really do love that one. But then The Muppets also did a Wizard of Oz adaptation.
You know, I don't think I've seen that one.
I haven't
either.
It was
made for TV. This is in the dark period of the Muppets, like where nobody remembers this because it was made for TV. Ashanti plays Dorothy, pop sensation Ashanti.
Yeah.
And Queen Latifah plays Auntie Em.
Oh, man.
This movie sounds like it's terrible, and in many ways it is.
I don't know. Queen Latifah's pretty amazing.
But here's the thing, is I watched this movie when I was babysitting, and these kids were like, we want to watch, you know, I have something to say about the adaptation of The Wizard of Oz in a second, but the Rayo was Roz. Muppet Wizard of Oz is really, really bad, but on paper it's got a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
Like, where it's like Fozzie is the Cowardly Lion, and so he's a stand-up comedian who has to, like, deal with his fear of being heckled. So of course the big test he has is to walk through this forest where, you know, Statler and Waldorf are like, they're like these demons that are underneath this bridge who are like, that joke is terrible, you know, and like Fozzie's like the Cowardly Lion as a comedian, so he's like trying to tell jokes, like using his tail as like a microphone. It's Miss Piggy plays all the witches, which is hilarious. And the Wicked Witch of the West is a biker. And Miss Piggy as a leathered biker with flying motorcycles.
Oh my
god. This adaptation is, like, when you're babysitting and you're, like, super bored, you're like, this is awesome. Like, it's really, it's
did
like,
I accidentally
it's not Thomas the Tank Engine.
Really, did I accidentally take acid and then come to
It's
baby
crazy. Sudden? It's crazy. And so, like, what the hell is Kermit? I guess Kermit is, he's not...
Is he Dorothy?
Or no, Ashanti is Dorothy. Yeah. And she's actually great.
Would he be the Scarecrow?
He is a Scarecrow. Okay. Yeah, he is a Scarecrow. Kermit's a Scarecrow, and Gonzo is, they call him the Tin Thing. Like, it's really, like, it's not bad. Like, and again, like, it's like one of those, like, when you're babysitting and you're bored, it's really, but it was also all the decisions they made, I was like, well, that's an amazing decision, Miss Piggy as all the witches. Like, that's really cool. Because then she can, like, do all the amazing Miss Piggy things. And, like, yeah, I don't know. And, like, yeah. The...
And, of course, she wouldn't settle for... She wouldn't allow anyone else to be another
right,
witch.
Right. Because there's something... Well, because which you haven't even seen it, but that's the meta conceit, is that at the beginning, Ashanti wants to audition to perform with the Muppets. The Muppets are a traveling troupe of actors who are auditioning people at the beginning of the movie. So, yeah. So, like, that sort of metafiction...
Oh my god.
Muppet Wizard of Oz, made for TV, not that bad as it turns out.
Oh my god.
Favorite Muppets was always, they had, I can't remember what the actual name of the, like, movie was called, but they had about six fairy tale retellings on, like, one video cassette that I used to watch all the time, because they had these different fairy tales. They had Rumpelstiltskin was one of them.
Who was Rumpelstiltskin?
Oh, I can't even remember. I think it was Gonzo.
Well, before we move into what we're reading currently, what would be something that hasn't been adapted yet that you would really like to see?
Apart from The Magicians.
Other than The Magicians.
Other than The Magicians. What would be your...
You
could also answer, what is your favorite adaptation of something? Mm. Whichever floats your boat.
Well, I feel like I've probably answered my favorite adaptations too much, so I'm not gonna. My favorite adaptations of all time are like Emma, Clueless, Muppets Christmas Carol, Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes. You know, so I think I've said that enough. Something that has not been adapted that I would like to see. There's not been a good adaptation of Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, which is a really funny comedic novel, and I feel like that it's time now. Mm-hmm. Okay. With everybody loves Downton Abbey in that era, and like the Edwardian era that Lucky Jim exists in. I think that would be really, really funny. In terms of something that's sort of more genre that's not The Magicians, I think The Magicians is number one for me. Something that's a little bit more maybe fantastic. I guess I would have to say that, you know, and all of these things are perpetually in the works, and again, this is somebody who's a good friend of mine, so it's hard for me to be not biased, but, like, I mean, really any of Karen Russell's books or short stories. I mean, like, Swamplandia supposedly will be a miniseries, but, like, I remember when I read that book, I was like, I called her and I was like, Wes Anderson directs the movie, and Bill Murray plays the dad. And she was like, right? You know, so I mean, I feel like that was one of those ones where, like, I feel like that's one that's just like, that's nonsense that's not really, really.
Well, now
happening.
She's a genius. I mean, she's an official genius. Yes. So maybe she can use some of that
according
money
to MacArthur.
Yeah. But I mean that those are. I mean, Magicians is still my number one though. I think that if I were 20, and the Magicians film came out after I saw the movie, I think that I would just feel like I lived in the best possible world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the casting would have to be really good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would have to be really good, and the direction would have to be like really hardcore and like really like sexy and young and sort of, but I think that not like a Twilight thing. Like it would have to be like really, like it would have to be like, it would have to look like Never Let Me Go, but not the pacing, you know, like it would have to, it would, you know, which is also a troubled adaptation, but like, but that film looked beautiful.
Also excellent cast.
But that's what I mean with casting is like, I feel like that if you did the Magicians, you'd want like the Never Let Me Go caliber of casting,
yeah.
You know, you'd want to just have it be that good. Mm-hmm. You know, like Carey Mulligan and them are in Garfield are too old now for something like that. But like whoever those younger stars are in the movie, God, who would play Quentin in the movie version of the Magicians? Can we even think?
Something that I was actually an article I was reading recently is that there aren't any like teenage or 20-something actors that people are really excited about. There are tons of women and teenage girls that people are like, these actresses are great. They're going to be working with us forever, like Kiernan Shipka, Hailee Steinfeld,
Maisie, what's her face from Game of Thrones.
Yes, and you can do that all the way up from like, you know, 15 through 30 easily for women, but you can't do it for men. And so everyone's like, what's going to happen here?
It'll all work out.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll find some.
So Bridget, what's yours?
Oh dear.
Well, I guess we already kind of talked about it.
Yeah.
Ours.
So yours is Sabriel.
Sabriel, yeah, 100%. Sign me up. Bells and dead people.
I would like a good one of the Golden Compass.
Yeah.
You just want a redo?
That's like me with
Lemony Snicket. Yeah. I just want a new series of unfortunate events.
Awesome.
Like, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what are you reading this week / lately?
What am I reading right now? I just read the new Lemony Snicket.
of course.
Big shock. When Did You See Her Last? Which I loved. I always claim that it's one of the best books I've read this year, which is still the case. I'm reading a lot of different things right now. I'm rereading Slaughterhouse-Five. That's a adaptation. Most Vonnegut adaptations are terrible. That film adaptation is okay. Stranger in a Strange Land. That's a film that needs to be made. Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. That's something Fassbender should play Valentine Michael Smith. That's one that's done. So I'm rereading Slaughterhouse-Five, for kind of my own bizarre reasons. I am reading, Fiona Mazzell's Woke Up Lonely.
She's a DMLA client.
Oh, how about that? I didn't know that. And
she's amazing. I love her.
You know, I've seen her across the room at a party. I thought, I just love that title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when I found out what it was about, I was like, wow. And it's really, really great. So I really like that. Everything from Lemony Snicket to Fiona Mazzell with a little Vonnegut in between. I'm gearing up to reread just reread The Hunger Games, you know, mm-hmm. to Catching Fire. I just reread that, so, because I'm pumped.
Yeah.
Nice. How about you?
I am currently reading Burial Rites by Hannah Kent, which I think I got it at BEA this year, so it either has already come out or will be coming out soon. But it's set in 1800s Iceland, and it's about the last woman to be put to death in Iceland. And so basically she's been convicted of murder, and so she's sort of sent off to live with this farm family to await her execution. And so it's sort of like a mix of perspectives, and it's about, I guess there are reasons why she killed this person. It was not just like random. It was sort of, it seems to have been like an abusive situation, but it's very, very well written, and it's been getting so many, like, been so lauded recently. It's from Little Brown, and it's just sort of it's like first page I read and I was like, oh wow, she's a fantastic writer. And of course she's like 23-year-old. I'm like, oh bitch. Damn it. 23-year-old Australian woman.
This is what you go to this podcast, we compliment you and tear you down at the same time.
You're
welcome.
You're so cool, we hate you so much.
I was reading this. It was like, this is this woman who was, I guess, 23 or 24 when she wrote this book. And she's Australian, and of course, the woman who just won the Man Booker Prize is a 28-year-old Australian
the
woman.
Luminaries.
And I'm like, yes, which I'm very much looking forward to reading. But I'm just like, these 20-something Australian women are...
kicking ass.
Doing well for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I've done a lot of reading the last week. I finally read Fangirl. I read it in one go. I loved it so much. I cried. I laughed. I sort of said,
"Sort of your life."
This is an uncomfortable. I mean, I'm not quite as
awkward
as she is, but you know, I definitely she's so awkward. Bless her heart. I mean, she's so great because and all the family stuff and like that family dynamic was just so like heartbreaking. But, you know, I definitely saw aspects of
myself. How often is that you read something and you're like, well, this character's got it way worse than me? You just read Kafka all day long, you're like, well, I don't feel that bad about my life.
Yeah, pretty much, you know? Pretty much. But, I mean, it's a really, really amazing
Look
book.
At
and
these
I,
idiots.
These fucking assholes. And then I started Codename Verity. I have not gotten far enough
Finally.
Into it to have an opinion yet. So far I'm enjoying it. But the thing that I've been bringing on the train, because I don't want to ruin your hardcover, is Aelith the Unseen.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Oh my god, I'm like 80 pages in and I'm just like dying.
Willow
so
Wilson,
good.
Yeah.
Yes. Ugh. Ugh, it's so good.
Yeah, no, I remember when that book was coming out, Grove Atlantic sent 4 copies of it to my office at separate times because they really want me to review this book. I ended up not reviewing it. I had somebody else review it for me because I liked it and I was like, I don't have an angle. You know,
yeah.
And like, no, that's, and that, yeah, wonderful, wonderful book.
It was
book,
pretty
yeah.
good.
It's a wonderful book. Yeah.
It's a techno thriller, kind of, but it's also a story about Islam, and it's also a story about the Arab Spring, and it's about security states, and it's about magic, and it's about so many things, and the center of it is this character that you just really just root for, and
there's nothing quite like that book. That's it's a really neat book.
I think it just got longlisted for the Orange Prize,
that
and she's
real.
Up against Bring Up
Which
the Bodies.
Which is no longer the Orange Prize. I don't know what it's
called. Something
Fuchsia.
Different.
Maybe Fuchsia? I don't know.
Well, Puce. No, because Orange was after the phone company that's in Britain and Europe, and I didn't realize that. Like, I knew the phone company was called Orange, but I didn't realize that they were the sponsors of this.
And now
they
accept
pulled
American...
out.
Yeah, and now they accept American...
No, that was the Booker.
That was the Booker? Okay,
that was the Booker.
And you know that the Pulitzer used to manufacture, you know, telephones also.
I didn't know
that's
that.
Not real. I made that
okay.
up.
Well, I didn't realize that Orange, the company, was actually the sponsor of this award until I found out that they were pulling out. And
those dicks.
So now I guess, I think it's the women's prize until
Phrasing.
They find a new
Something.
Sponsor. Oh dear, that sounds really dirty.
Remember when I made the fisting joke last episode? Well, on that note.
Why was it a joke?
It's time for us to shut this down.
Well, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you
for coming. Ryan, for being here,
thank
being
you.
A guest.
Thank
it was
you.
A pleasure to have you.
And thank you so much for listening, and we hope you will join us for another episode of Shipping and Handling.
Bye.
Bye. This has been Shipping and Handling. You can find updates on our new episodes at shippingandhandlingpodcast.com. The opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and not those of Donald Moss Literary Agency or Dunham Literary Incorporated. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.